The 22nd European Congress on Obesity, ECO, hosted by the European Association for the Study of Obesity, took place in Prague, Czech Republic, in May 2015. Obesity remains a major public health priority in Europe, with prevalence continually increasing, as highlighted in a presentation by the WHO Regional Office for Europe. Their obesity forecast exercise indicates that unless immediate action is taken, the proportion of overweight or obese adults in Europe will rise by the year 2030. ECO raises awareness of this issue and provides a platform to promote, inform, and engage in the latest scientific developments in the field. The varied programme drew over 1,200 participants from 73 countries worldwide and featured a range of obesity-related topics. UFIC interviewed seven of the speakers at the conference, who summarised their research findings. Dr. Gemma Frubeck has been president of the European Association for the Study of Obesity for the last 3 years.
The association is responsible for organising ECO each year.
So, Gemma, what are the main objectives for the conference?
Since obesity is such a prevalent disease, one of the main objectives with the Congress is to have a broader insight into the understanding of why obesity is happening, and also which type of management efforts we can do to help our patients to try to see which interventions might be useful for preventing obesity.
You've been president for the last 3 years. What's been your role during this time?
As president of the association, I'm involved in leading all of the task forces, the Obesity Management Task Force, the Childhood Obesity Task Force, and the Prevention and Public Health Task Force. They produce all their roles, just making sessions for and workshops for the Congress, but also delivering position statements and papers and organizing teaching courses. So as a president, I need to supervise and be aware of what is being done. We also last year established the Patient Council, which is a very important initiative for the association because it means giving a voice to the patients. It's always nice to know about the scientific background of obesity, but we can't neglect the opinion and the views and the perspectives and the needs of the patients. So I am in charge of looking at the Patient Council. Another of the activities that we engage on regularly is an industry roundtable, because we promote a stakeholder approach so that we engage with industry and also know about their needs and how we can work together, collaborate, and have synergistic effects.
What were the main topics of this year's Congress?
One of the very interesting things of obesity, it impinges on all organ systems. So we have a lot of activities going around adipose tissue biology, but also the connection to the other tissues. So the muscle is important, the liver is important, the heart is important, the kidneys. This is basic science mainly. Then we have also clinical management information, where you have the nutritional approach, pharmacological approach, but also the surgical approach. And last but not least, also the prevention, let's say, group, in which the interventions that have been carried out are presented to really try to see how we can really combat obesity. And unluckily, we have been failing really to prevent obesity in the last decades, and we really need to think why this is happening. So the Childhood Obesity Task Force and also with the Obesity Management Task Force, we need to work together in a transdisciplinary way to really try to combat obesity.
So how do you see the future of the conference?
The future looks bright, I have to say. In spite of the prevalence rates of obesity continuing to increase, I believe that a lot has been done. We have increased our activities as a society in all aspects, with the task forces, with position statements, with teaching courses. One of the things that we have been thinking about is if we need to change the structure of the Congress, because everything is published so quickly, you can really have access quite rapidly. So we need to be aware of other possibilities like live streaming or video conferences and taking advantage of all the technology that is now in our hands. So this is one of the tasks the Executive Committee is undertaking.
Susan Mickey is Professor of Health Psychology at University College London. Her research covers the area of behaviour change. During her talk, she mentioned that when aiming to change a particular behaviour, it's important to understand the context in which this particular behaviour takes place. Could you tell us a bit more about this?
What we know is that behaviours are part of a system of lots of other behaviours. So, for example, if one wants to try and go down to the gym to have some exercise, it's not as if it's going to the gym versus not going to the gym. There are other attractive behaviours. For example, lying on the sofa, eating crisps, drinking wine, looking at the television. So one has to think about how to increase a behaviour and decrease other behaviours if one's going to change behaviour. So one of the things is to think about what other behaviours are there that actually get in the way of doing what one wants to do, or what other behaviours are there that could actually help. The other thing we know about behaviour is that it's not just part of a network of behaviours within you as an individual, but it's also very influenced by other people's behaviours. So we know, for example, that if you have a buddy, say, to go to the gym with, you have some social support. If you feel like not going to the gym, the other person may be phoning you up saying, you know, where are you? And also one's actual material environment, you know, the context of a behaviour that we actually live in. How many people can afford to be a member of a gym, have got a gym near them? Not many. So the behaviour can be influenced by other behaviours of oneself, other people, or actually the situation and the material context in which one lives or works.
In order to identify what the active ingredients for behaviour change are, it's important to very precisely characterise behaviour change techniques. Can you tell us a bit more about your work in this area?
If one wants to identify the kind of behaviour change techniques that are likely to be effective, it's really important to understand the behaviour and what needs to change. So if we take a very simple model of behaviour and behaviour change, we can think about there are three aspects of behaviour that need to change in order for a behaviour to occur. Those three are motivation. Somebody needs to be motivated to actually enact a behaviour. If they're not motivated, it's not going to happen. Secondly, they need to have the capability, whether it's a psychological capability in terms of skills and knowledge, or whether it's physical capability. If they don't have the capability, the behaviour is not going to happen. And thirdly, they need to have the opportunity, both the physical opportunity, but also the social opportunity for the behaviour. If you don't have the opportunity, it doesn't happen. You could then think about what kind of intervention is likely to be most effective, and then identify specific techniques that might be helpful. Those areas have a number of behaviour change techniques associated with them. In fact, we've identified 93 different behaviour change techniques. Now, when you want to develop an intervention to change behaviour, of course one doesn't want to have huge numbers of techniques, and often less is more. It's better just going with one or two that are really likely to be effective given the behaviour in context that one's already analysed. And so we've developed different frameworks and different sets of criteria to help people think about which of these techniques are likely to be most effective, dependent on the analysis of what needs to change to bring about that behaviour.
What are important elements to maintain behaviour change?
Changing behaviour is not easy, as we all know, but actually maintaining behaviour change is even more difficult. The absolute key thing is to ensure that that initial enthusiasm and motivation gets translated into strategies that can support the change long term. Things like building up habits and routines so that when people are in particular situations, they do the new behaviour rather than the old behaviour. And there are ways of achieving that. One of the key things is to think about how to change routines and how to change one's environment, you know, one's physical and also one's social environment, in order to support the behaviour change. What tends to happen is people have this initial burst of enthusiasm, things do change for a bit, and then it kind of fades away, and then people get demoralised. So the key thing is to think long term right from the beginning. as we know, people do achieve very impressive changes in their behaviour, whether it's diet, physical activity, stopping smoking, etc. But one might as well start off with all the tools in place at the beginning rather than halfway through scrabbling around trying to find them.
Hannah Kontinen is a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Social Research at the University of Helsinki. She studied the relationship between depression and obesity. Hannah, can you start by explaining what depression actually is?
In science, the term depression is used to mean very different things. It can include different kind of symptoms, both psychological and somatic symptoms. The core psychological symptoms are usually sad mood, loss of interest, reduced energy, a low self-esteem. And then somatic symptoms can include changes in appetite, both increase and decrease in appetite, and also various kind of sleeping problems, such as sleeping too little or sleeping too much.
And how is depression related to obesity?
The association between depression and obesity is quite complex. Depressive symptoms can lead to both weight gain or weight loss. It depends on the individual and the situation. We also know that the relationship between depression and obesity is bidirectional. Depression can lead to later development of obesity, and then obesity can lead to later development of depression. There can be several mechanisms. For example, there can be reduced motivation and self-confidence for a healthy lifestyle. Also, depression can lead to changes in appetite, which can then lead problems in the regulation of eating, and this can then lead to weight gain. Then if we think about if obesity leads to later onset of depression, we well know obese people encounter discrimination as well as negative attitudes. These kind of issues can lead to lower self-esteem, which can then lead to increased depressive symptoms, and then we can have a cycle of influences between depressive symptoms and weight changes.
How about your research in this area?
We have quite recently conducted two studies related to depression and weight changes. Two different psychosocial factors explain the positive association between depression and obesity: eating in response to negative emotions and low confidence in the ability to maintain physical activity behaviors. We found that these two factors did explain the positive association between depression and higher BMI, higher waist circumference, and higher body fat percent. In the second study, we were interested in the association between depressive symptoms and weight changes over time. We used data which covered 20 years from the Finnish population. And we found in that data that higher initial depressive symptoms among men predicted a faster increase in body mass index. But among women, we did not find this association. Among women, we found some evidence that higher body mass index predicts a later increase in depressive symptoms.
What are the main implications of your research findings?
If we think about weight control programs, our results suggest that it is important to address depressive symptoms. We also need to develop more methods to improve people's ability to cope with different kind of traits related to appetite, for example, emotional eating. Also, it is very important to increase their confidence in the ability to maintain a healthy lifestyle. Then if we think about implications on societal and policy level, we need more actions to change the current food and physical activity environment to make it easier for people to lead a healthier life. Also, I think there is a high need to reduce the weight-based stigmatization, because we know that the negative attitudes that obese people encounter and the discrimination, it doesn't help in losing weight. Actually, we know it can have negative effects in losing or maintaining the lost weight.
Dr. Mark Hopkins is a senior lecturer in exercise physiology at Sheffield Hallam University. His current research focuses on the relationship between body composition and both energy intake and energy expenditure. Can you provide us with a bit of background information on this topic?
Yeah, so my research is looking at the drivers of energy intake, so what are the mechanisms that stimulate food intake. And traditionally, people thought that the kind of controlling mechanisms stem from fat mass and also some hormones that stem from the kind of gut. But we're starting to look at whether things like fat-free mass and resting metabolic rate play an important role in day-to-day food intake.
How about the research you carried out?
We wanted to look at the relationship between body composition, energy expenditure and food intake, and particularly look at those relationships when food choice was allowed to vary freely. So we really wanted to look at whether fat-free mass and resting metabolic rate were drivers of food intake. We looked at about 60 individuals who spent a 14-day period in a residential feeding suite. These individuals had access to a wide range of foods typical of their normal diet. They were able to move around freely and do daily activities and actually cooked all their own foods in a private kind of kitchen. We covertly and objectively measured food intake, and the researchers every morning would go into these kitchens and measure all the food, the packaging, the waste material, any peelings. So we could then calculate energy and macronutrient intake. We measured body composition and total daily energy expenditure using WA water, so quite a sophisticated and accurate measure. And we found that fat mass wasn't related to food intake, which is quite an interesting finding because previous researchers suggested that fat mass really controls food intake. However, our findings suggested that fat-free mass was highly related to the amount of food people were consuming. Interestingly, when we started to look at the relationship between fat-free mass and resting metabolic rate, we found that actually resting metabolic rate seemed to be the most important determinant. So we did a statistical analysis and found that it was resting metabolic rate that seems to be the most important factor in determining day-to-day food intake in these individuals.
So what are the implications of your findings? How can this be taken from a controlled setting and implemented in everyday life?
So there's a number of conditions that are associated with reductions in fat-free mass. As people become older, we tend to get a reduction in fat-free mass, and certain diseases are associated with a reduction in fat-free mass. And we often see a dysregulation or an effect on appetite within these conditions as well. So if we know that fat-free mass and resting metabolic rate are playing an important role in food intake, then we might be able to put interventions together that improve fat-free mass and then hopefully have a beneficial effect on appetite in these individuals. Typically, when we're looking at obesity-based interventions, people use aerobic exercise to reduce fat mass, but we often see a reduction in fat-free mass with those as well. So I think it kind of underlines the importance of putting resistance-based exercise within an intervention, because then we maintain, if not increase, fat-free mass. And that might be particularly important in the elderly population as well. As I said, they often see a reduction in fat-free mass, which might then have a knock-on effect on appetite control in these individuals.
Christina Bry is a PhD student at the Technical University of Munich. She studied the effects of long-chain omega-3 fatty acids in pregnant women on body composition and fat mass of their babies. Christina, what was the rationale of this study?
Childhood overweight and obesity are a rapidly growing health problem in many countries, and measures need to be taken to reverse this trend. The ratio of long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids, ACPUFA for short, in the maternal diet may have an impact on offspring body composition and weight. We investigated the effect of reducing the omega-6, omega-3 fatty acid ratio in the maternal diet during pregnancy and lactation to see if there is an effect on offspring growth and body composition. It was the first prospective randomized controlled trial worldwide which tested this hypothesis on infant body composition.
Can you tell us a bit more about the intervention that you carried out?
In total, 208 healthy pregnant women were randomly assigned to either a dietary intervention group or to a control group. The dietary intervention group received official supplement with 1.2 gram omega-3 fatty acids and also received a dietary advice to normalize their arachidonic acid intake to a moderate level of about 90 milligram per day. And arachidonic acid is an omega-6 fatty acid and is found, for example, in eggs, in butter, in meat or meat products. And on the other hand, the woman in the control group just received a brief general counseling on a healthy diet. We followed the newborns of the mothers originally for 1 year, but then the study was extended up to 5 years of age. The primary endpoint was the skin fold thickness measurements, and out of that, we can also calculate the body fat and the lean body mass of the infants. We also assessed infant body composition using ultrasound and MRI techniques, and we wanted to assess growth indices like weight, height, BMI percentiles, and some circumferences like head, waist, and arm circumference of the infants.
So what were the main findings of your study?
When we analyzed the maternal blood and the diet of the pregnant woman, we saw that the omega-6, omega-3 ratio was altered significantly in the woman in the intervention group in comparison with the control group, and that indicates that our nutritional intervention was successful. The newborns in the intervention group showed a higher weight and growth indices on average at birth due to prolonged gestation, which is explainable due to the supplementation of N3 fatty acids. But those differences completely disappeared by the follow-up visits. Regarding our primary endpoint, the skin fold thickness measurements, they did not differ between the groups at any of the time points, which suggests that both groups have the same amount of body fat in total and the lean body mass.
What are the main implications of your findings?
Up to now, our results provide no evidence to support our initial hypothesis that obesity in early life can be prevented with a modification of the omega-6, omega-3 fatty acid ratio. This suggests that if a woman is taking supplements of omega-3 fatty acids during pregnancy and lactation, she's not able to limit adipose tissue growth in her baby and the toddlers up to 5 years of age. Therefore, we need other strategies to handle and overcome this global problem of childhood overweight and obesity. There are available data which suggest that there are associations of omega-3 fatty acid supplementation with the later body weight, but also the risk of allergic diseases and cognitive performance. In order to address these questions, we extended our follow-up from 1.5 years to 5 years and tried to assess the neurodevelopment of the children and the allergic disorders. We are currently analyzing our data and hope to get initial results soon.
Tracy Barnett works as a professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the National Research Institute, as well as the Sainte-Justine University Hospital Research Centre, both in Montreal, Canada. She's investigated the relationship between the built environment and overweight and obesity in children.
One thing that we noticed is if you compare across various neighborhoods, there is quite a variation in the prevalence of obesity. And this would be over and above certain individual factors. If you correct for those factors, you still see these differences. So it suggests that there is something at the neighborhood level that could be driving these differences. The idea was to try to identify or pinpoint which characteristics would be most important, most salient, potentially, to determine the likelihood of being overweight or obese. We limited a neighborhood around children's homes. And so we defined the neighborhoods various ways, which could have been, for example, a walking network around the house up to 500 meters. We did a very detailed audit of the street segments. We visited all of the parks that were within approximately 1 kilometer of the house when they lived close to their school. And so we had teams of observers that essentially went and described many facets of the micro and meso environment, if you will. Things related to the sidewalks, to the infrastructures, to things that help pedestrians, to things that slow down traffic. We also had a geographic information system, or a GIS, where we got broader indicators, for example, the average income in a certain neighborhood, the average education, also things related to the road network, connectivity, land use mix. In other words, are there many shops and various destinations and things you can do in your neighborhood, or is it entirely residential with very little that you can do? Are they streets where you can easily get from one place to another, or are you more in a design where you're sort of in a suburban prison and really would have to take your car to get anywhere to do anything?
What were the main findings of this analysis?
We measured a huge number of variables, of course, I think well over 300, and ended up having three factors that really emerged as being important. One of them had to do with the walkability on a broader level. Again, it has to do with having many destinations, a variety of things in your neighborhood, how walkable it is in terms of intersections, and you can easily get from one place to another. Another factor had to do with traffic, vehicular traffic in particular, how many streets and the actual road lengths and the proportion of roads that had heavy traffic, what was the volume of traffic going by. And then the third one had to do with pedestrian aids. You know, if you had some zebra crossings and if you had dedicated lights and lots of speed limits that were making it easier to walk, or, you know, buffers between the sidewalk and the street and things of this nature. What we found was that the neighborhoods that were described by the worst profiles in terms of vehicular traffic and not very good in terms of pedestrian aids, that's where we were most likely to find the more obese children. This was even after controlling for social factors such as the average neighborhood education or income, taking into account both of their parents' body mass index, their pubertal status.
So what are the main implications and lessons from this study?
There are important inequities in the opportunities that children have depending on where they live, and in other work that we've done, also where they study and where they play. Some will afford many opportunities to be active and others less. Their neighborhoods as well. Some will have been designed for walking and walking to school, and others will not because they're simply not safe enough. So the first thing is to be aware of this so that we can start to think about how we can best address it. This is not something that can be changed overnight, but I think if we have a well-thought-out, structured approach and we're aware of it, we can at least opportunistically start to do very simple things that'll make our environments or neighborhoods more walkable. There are some neighborhoods that have been really proactive with this, that have made their neighborhoods extremely bicycle-friendly, have tried to make it difficult to drive through their neighborhoods. These are the types of findings that are important to communicate. That's little steps. For example, just making the neighborhood around the school a little more accessible and safer. Within 1 to 2 kilometers around a school, the children would be expected to walk to school. So let's make sure that most of them are doing that.
Knut Inge Klepp is Director General of the Division of Epidemiology at the Norwegian Institute of Public Health and Adjunct Professor at the University of Oslo. His talk was about food reformulation and front-of-pack labelling. We first asked him what food reformulation is.
By food reformulation, to take the existing food and change it in some way or the other. You can take away some ingredient, trans fat, for example, or you want to reduce certain components, less salt, less sugar, more fiber could be a way to then increase the healthy component.
How can one assess the potential impact that food reformulation can have on public health?
There are many different aspects you can look at. One is to monitor whatever is there in terms of policies or action in order to motivate or support the industry for doing this. So that could be legislation in terms of taxes or even banning certain ingredients. We see a lot of effort in terms of having labels with underlying nutrient profiling. And there are some interesting studies looking at the products then that are being produced and are coming to the market. In Norway, we see that in the last 5 years, the number of products with the Nordic keyhole label has gone up from about 400 to about 2,000. And then the question is, what impact does that have on people's purchasing behavior? And there's some interesting modeling work done both in Norway and Netherlands showing that if people, in fact, do replace the regular products with these reformulated products, that would have a big impact on the health of the population. In Norway, we do national dietary surveys. Then we took the regular products that they ate, such as milk, and replaced it with the products that had qualified for the keyhole symbol. And we did that across all the food groups. And then we could calculate the nutrient content. And we see that it has a big impact, particularly on the content of saturated fat. So if you did this replacement, then the average consumption in the population would be very close to the recommended level. And also for dietary fiber, we see that it would have a big impact. In addition, it would have positive effects both on sugar and salt intake. So far, I'm not aware of any studies that have followed this even further to see does it really have on the population base an impact on people health-related outcomes such as weight status.
You mentioned the front-of-pack Nordic keyhole label. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
It is a very simple. It's just a green keyhole. It was developed in Sweden and we launched as a Nordic symbol in 2009. Criteria for different food groups all relate to four ingredients, and that is the fat content, total and quality of fat, the fiber and whole grain content of the product, and the sugar and salt content. So pending on what food group it is, it has to comply with the criteria for one or more of these four set of nutrient criteria. All seafood and fish, and also fresh fruit and vegetables, have by definition the keyhole, while there are other food groups such as we've got soft drinks and sweets that will never get a keyhole, even if they are reformulated.
What were the main take-home messages from your talk?
Well, I think it is very clear, looking across different sectors, that there's a lot of support for the industry engaging in a reformulation of the foods, and particularly the food that people do eat a lot of. Then it is clear that there are a number of strategies, such as these nutrient profiling programs and the labeling and other policy initiatives. That's important for the industry to really try to reformulate some of their products. And if you do reformulate and the public actually buy the reformulated products, that is going to have a big impact on diet and therefore in the long run also on the health of the population. A final conclusion is that it's important that these new reformulated products are competitive price-wise so that we reach the groups with lower socioeconomic status, and that this measure contribute to reducing rather than increase social inequality in health in Europe.
Food Today, science-based information on food, nutrition and safety. From UFIC, the European Food Information Council.